You're listening to the Net Mums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Alison Perry. Coming up on this week's show...
We're going to be sick on the car seat and you've left the wet wipes in Wagamamas.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what... They know all this stuff. They're a lot cleverer than they let on, aren't they?
This episode of the Net Mums podcast is brought to you by Heinz, the best choice for baby food.
Alison, we've chatted about weaning before and I know you found it stressful. I'm not surprised with twins. Was it seriously messy?
Oh my goodness, Wendy. I think that we still actually have some puree that is basically welded onto our kitchen wall 5 years later after it was chucked there by a small parson.
I think the more they enjoy it, the more it seems to go everywhere. The only thing I seem to be able to get my daughters to eat was Heinz baby food.
Yes, Heinz has got so many pouches now, which would have made feeding my picky twins so much easier and so much tastier when they were little.
The range of flavours is incredible, especially the new Heinz Immunity Support Pouches range. They've added vitamin C.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I bet parents are stocking up on those. They're actually different from anything I've seen before.
Head to Heinz for Baby on Instagram or TikTok to find out more.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode. Wendy, how are you doing? How's your week been?
I never thought I'd say this, but I'm feeling broody. You can probably hear my ovaries clanging from the other side of the phone. So this is all because on Saturday we went to the theatre and I was sat next to the smiliest baby in the world on the train on the way home. And I might have had a margarita or two, so I might have been very excited and I was transported back to babydom. But at the coalface of that sleepless night's lark, I never thought I'd want a baby again. Do that, or was twins totally ruined it for you?
I am horrified, Wendy. Only because do you know what? If you'd asked me 7 years ago when I had one child and we were like struggling with secondary infertility and we really wanted another, I would have been like, oh yeah, when I see a cute baby, I love it. Now, with 5-year-old twins as well as a 13-year-old, yeah. I'm done. I'm like, I now know what it feels like when other people have said in the past, no, I know I'm done. I always was like, really? How do you know?
Oh, no, I know. I think our guest today is the perfect person to talk to about babies because he's caught his fair share in his time. And he's a dad to two very, very small toddlers. So there's lots to talk about.
There is. We're joined today. I'm very excited to be joined today by Adam Kay, our former doctor who became a literary sensation when his debut book, This Is Going to Hurt, sold over 3 million copies and was adapted into a multi-BAFTA winning comedy drama series for the BBC. Since then, Adam has become a dad of two and has become one of the UK's best-selling children's authors. No big deal. His new book, Dexter Proctor, the 10-year-old Doctor, is a very funny novel for readers age 7 and up. Adam, a warm welcome to the Net Mums podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to meet you. Now, you're in the rather unusual position of having babies who are 4 months apart.
Yes.
For anyone who hasn't followed your parenting journey, tell us how that slightly odd age gap came about.
So both babies were born through surrogacy, through two separate surrogates, two very dear friends of ours. And as a result, obviously surrogacy involves the vagaries of IVF. And you don't quite know what's going to happen when. And then Ruby, our first, was born bit premature, and so the dice landed such that they were 4 months apart. So sort of they're in the same school year, or will be when they're that age, so sort of de facto twins. But yeah, it's a lot, isn't it?
Oh yes. How is fatherhood, Adam? Tell us.
Well,
it's 9 o'clock in the morning, dear listener. How long have you been up, Adam?
I've been up since 5, which is normal. So
that's not too bad.
I mean, you say that. It is quite bad, isn't it?
Well, I think mine were like sometimes 4. So,
okay. Well, yeah, I guess 5's better than 4 and 4's better than 3. So our babies, Whisper It, currently, time of press, sleep well. So they sleep for 11 hours a night.
Wow.
However, they're not the hours I'd like them to sleep, because, you know, I'd like it to happen during the night that they sleep, but they, you know, but so they get up quite early and they go to sleep quite early, but we do, you know, they do have a routine somehow, and we're not touching a thing because we've got so many friends who, like, you know, have these 90 minute sleeping patterns. So, I mean, sleeping, no complaints. Actually, I'm not going to say no complaints overall, because I don't know, it improves your life in every measurable way, but at the same time is awful. So it's like there's a huge net gain, and I wouldn't have it any other way, but there is so much I would change. Like, I just can't understand the people, you know, the influencers who social media is intent at show me saying how wonderful their life is, and they wouldn't change a thing. You would change a thing. Come on. You change the sleeping, the nappies, the, I don't know, the relentlessness.
There are bits you would definitely change.
There are. So I think we're sold a bit of a lie by that I wouldn't change a thing. And there's so much I wouldn't change, and they bring... And every week, they're either side of 18 months at the moment, and they're doing amazing new things every week. But at the same time, they do need to calm down. Come on, lads.
Oh, I feel your pain. And I remember you saying something quite similar when you were on Desert Island Discs last year. You were saying that your babies had transformed your lives for the better, but also ruined it. So I was really interested to know, what would you say are the biggest changes that it's made to your life, apart from obviously waking up at 5 a.m?
I think I took my relationship for granted prior to the babies, and I hadn't realized how important it is to carve out time. And if I was rewinding back to them being born, I would have been better at making sure that we always have a certain time a week that somehow, I don't quite know how it would happen, is just us, because you can, you know, I do not understand, I have to say, how single parents do it, because as far as it's a totally full-time job for the two of us at home. We work from home. We're at home full-time. It's more than full-time for us. I don't know how the maths works. Yep. But so I think that's been a big learning curve, and just got used to, you know, because we've been together for 14 years before having kids. We came to the kids game very, very late in the scheme of a lot of couples. And I think I just got used to the fact that, oh, should we just go to the pub, or should we just go and grab dinner, or maybe we could pop into London? And so that's evaporated. Ruby was born.
That was the bit I missed the most, actually, when I first became a mum, was the spontaneity of your relationship, and the should we just go to the pub? And you can't just go to the pub anymore.
You can't just do anything. Like, even things that are in the diary that you know are going to happen, there has to be this planning stage. I feel I need I need like a team of assistants, and someone sending me a list of the stuff I need to pack, and like, it's just too much. We went out for like 3 hours yesterday, and I think there was a good 3 hours beforehand making sure we had everything sorted out, and then an hour and a half afterwards getting everything back into the house so we could live our lives again. So, I mean, that's a big thing, and it sounds obvious, but it's only obvious once you've done it. I also, in my, you know, you imagine what it's going to be like ahead of your kids being born, and I hadn't imagined Ruby being born prem, and prematurity comes with various problems sometimes. And she's not been super, super sick, but she has, you know, needed a fair bit of, you know, medical help. And she's a you know, delicate little duckling still. And so, you know, any little, you know, bug that's doing the rounds will knock her, you know, totally sideways. And I hadn't realized I'd be spending so much time hanging out with former colleagues from the medical side, because in your head everything just goes, you know, perfectly, like the book you bought about, you know, what happens every single month. You expect them to do what they what it says in the book they're meant to do. And I think the final thing that I realize as I'm about to say it, it's going to make me sound like I hadn't thought this through at all, but it's relentless. And weekends are the toughest. I think you get to the end. So we get to the end of a weekend, whatever, and then we're like, oh, good, they've gone to bed. We can watch some telly and go to bed. But then there's no one to take over. It's when I did a hard shift as a doctor, I got some time off afterwards, and you can't finish your 12-hour shift and someone immediately phone and say, oh, sorry, can you come back and do another 3 days? But it is relentless. And I think the times that we struggle are when we think that we've, you know, got to the end of a tough shift, and then it immediately restarts. So,
and they have a way of knowing. They know when you're on your knees, and that's when they decide, tonight I'm going to be sick all over my cot. And you're like, okay, said that.
Yeah, and we're going to be sick on the car seat, and you've left the wet wipes in Wagamama's.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they know all this stuff. They're a lot cleverer than they let on, aren't they?
So you've said in the past that you and your husband James approach it by taking turns with things like the night feeds, although it sounds like the night feeds might, don't whisper it.
Yeah, no, hopefully touching. I don't think this is real wood, but I'm still touching it. that seems not to be a thing, but we try to be fairly equal about the terrible jobs, of which there are many.
Pretty 50-50.
Yeah. He is, he's a very, very natural dad, and he's just, I think he's probably a more fun person than me, and just, you know, just is very great at being big and silly and, filling the time and getting, you know, grabbing pots and pans and boxes and things and, you know, making spaceships and things. So I'm learning an awful lot from him about how to do all the playing stuff. I'm not sure when my skills are going to come in. Presumably when it comes to GCSE biology or something, I can teach him about the liver.
We're going to come on to that in a minute. I've got a question about you and your teaching children things, Mr. Adam Kay.
I'm so fascinated, though. I mean, being a mum of twins, I'm so fascinated by the age gap. And, you know, granted, you don't know any different. But what's it been like as they've hit milestones? Like, do they hit them at different, slightly different times? Or is Ruby catching up with her brother? Or how is it? Or is it the other way around, actually? Because actually, she was born first, even though she was premature. How is it working?
So Ruby's older and tiny. Ziggy is younger and big. And so they've always looked like they were the other way around age wise. And, you know, Ziggy was practically, you know, running when he was, you know, when he was 10 months old, and Ruby didn't take a step until a few weeks ago, really, until around the 18 month stage. So, that's been, their milestones have just been completely chaotic. But, you know, milestones are just a guide to go and see, you know, to ask the question, is everything okay here? And because Ruby's had lots of support around her, we've had people saying, oh, she'll give her time. She's small. She'll work it out. And in fairness, she has. But she's always been bright as a button. And so she's, you know, so interested in the world, and she started speaking quite quickly. And I do think that Ziggy's had to up his game to be able to keep up with his big sister. And I know this. I know that she's teaching him things because he says some word in a quite peculiar way that he's just picked up from her. So like, she learned to say hello, which she says hello in that, in a very distinctive way, which was desperately cute.
Yeah.
And then he's saying it in exactly the same way. So either they're both, you know, they're both watching the same TV show without us knowing, where someone says hello like that, or he's copying her. So it's cute, but
that's very cute.
They're getting on with it. We're letting them get on with it.
That's all you can do, I guess. Now, you've said that medicine is a career choice that follows for academically gifted scientists, but you've suggested that it's not a given that the same group will be emotionally secure enough to handle the non-academic demands. How do you think that future doctors should be recruited to take account of that gap between academic and emotional ability?
I mean, that's a very good question. I think hopefully Wes Streeting's listening to this, because we, you know, one of the big problems we have at the moment is not enough doctors, but B, too many doctors leaving. Last year, 10 doctors quit the NHS. Every single day, more doctors quit the profession than retired. It's an absolute crisis. And it's not just about, well, we need to train more people up. You can't run the taps in the bath if the plug's out. So getting the right people there is absolutely crucial. So at the moment, we get people with straight A's at A level, and we insist they've got all sorts of extracurricular activities and interests, and we insist they do work experience in a hospital environment. And I think I would rip up all of those three things, because straight A's at A level, the best doctors aren't the cleverest doctors. It is not a job about, you know, memorizing biochemical pathways. It's a job about communicating. And, you know, you need to have the basic level of knowledge, but that isn't necessarily a straight A person. I think we're losing a lot of brilliant would-be doctors by insisting on these straight A's. And so I would drop the academic requirements right down, and I would really, really put it massively onto the interview. And as part of the interview, as well as, you know, working out, does this person seem like they'd be a good, kind, empathetic doctor who understands what the job would involve and how they're going to cope with the bad days? I think I would restrict it to a postgraduate entry. I think that it's very difficult at 18 years old to know what how you are going to cope. I think it might be, you know, you're an idiot when you're 18. It's fair, I mean, but you're meant to be. But when you've, a few years later, if you've left home, if you've had to earn some money for yourself, if you potentially had a relationship, all these things that sort of open up your outlook on the world, I think that makes you in a much better position to give informed consent, you would call it in the medical profession. When you go for a procedure, they say, here are the benefits and here are the risks. And I think you're still an idiot when you're 21, obviously, but I think you're in more of a position to work out what the risks are to you and whether this is actually right. I would also definitely get rid of the extracurricular stuff. You have to have grade 8 OBA and be captain of the rugby team, because that is essentially a way of increasing the odds if you went to a fee-paying school. They can't say, you know, we want a high proportion of kids from private schools, because that's against the law, and, you know, and everyone will go to prison involved with it. But the fact that they sort of, you know, insist on high level extramural stuff, which is the stuff that obviously some certain schools, you know, pride themselves on, and, you know, not that it obviously doesn't happen in the state sector, but, you know, the facilities, the lacrosse pitches or whatever they're called, you know, in private schools are always going to be better. That feels a bit ugly to me. And likewise, insisting on work experience. Most kids, the only doctor they know is the one who provides their, you know, their antibiotics and their asthma inhaler, or their, you know, their epilepsy meds or their insulin or whoever. chances are, you know, you're at one of these private schools, you're more likely to, you know, have parents who hang out in the playground with a bunch of other, you know, surgeons and anaesthetists and whatever, who can say, oh no, we'll sort him out with some work experience, don't you worry. So there's a lot I would change about it, with the eventual aim of not just keeping the doctors in the job because they're best suited to it, but also making sure that the doctors, and the same applies across all the healthcare professions, but making sure that the doctors represent their patients.
This is a quick reminder that this episode is brought to you by Heinz, the best choice for baby food.
Whether you're just starting out on the weaning journey, you've got a picky eater, or a baby who loves new flavours, Heinz is the best choice for you.
Their huge range of pouches and delicious flavours makes it so easy for us parents.
Head to Heinz for Baby on Instagram or TikTok to find out more.
So we're recording this, it's July. At the moment, we've just had a general election and we have a new government in place. What are your hopes for the NHS and what words do you have for our new health minister?
I am hopeful, and this is going out in the future, so time will tell. I'm very hopeful, actually, on the basis that things are in a terrible state at the moment. I've not witnessed the NHS ever in the state that it is at the moment, and it needs some.
Can I just interrupt and say, given the state it was in when you wrote "this is going to hurt," is a relatively significant statement to make.
Oh, those were the good old days. It turned out I don't know what I was complaining about. It's like literally, I'm speaking to my, you know, a former colleague, still my mate, working in the health service. It's impossibly difficult. You know, I wrote about doing one person's job. You know, my mates are now doing three people's jobs because the other two have moved to Australia, and it's hard to blame them. So hopefully by the time people are listening to this, the strikes will be a thing of the past, and the new government will have seen sense and come to an arrangement with the junior doctors, and hopefully there will be a plan for the NHS, because at the moment the plan seems to have been one of hope, and hope is not a strategy, and like they've just been hoping the waiting list's down, and somehow that's not worked.
Strange that.
Funny.
Yeah, it's weird. Ultimately, the NHS does need a lot more money. That's the only way to. There's a boring concept called health inflation, which is the amount of money you need to pump into a health service wherever you are in the world to provide the same level of service you did the year before. And that's sort of around 3% on top of inflation. And that accounts for your population getting older, getting sicker. It accounts for new medicines, new scanners, all this technology stuff coming in. And if you don't do that, then each subsequent year, you know, your health service is more stretched than the year before. So anytime, you know, a minister names a number that's less than 3% on top of inflation, then they are actually making life tougher for the people there. So, I mean, I know that what they talk about ahead of an election isn't necessarily what happens, but a number of 1.something% was mentioned, which did worry me. But I mean, but that was before they're in power. Let's see what happens. There's been some stuff talked about, which I found very encouraging. A lot of talk about prevention. And prevention has to be the answer. You prevent illness. Prevention is better than cure. And prevention is more than just, you know, public health campaigns and smoking and alcohol and things like that. It's housing and it's employment, because you don't have a healthy population if they're not in good jobs and if they're not in good accommodation and they don't have the social support that they need. So that's been talked about, which is good. Joining up health and social care has been talked about. That's been talked about since long before I was born, but it's the same issue. If someone can't be discharged from a ward because there's nowhere for them to move into because they don't have the social care in place, then that backs up until an ambulance can't get into the A&E department. And and it's so far I've heard some good things being said. I've met Wes Streeting in the past at a social event, at one of these sort of charity award things, and he was very nice and clearly very smart, and I've been impressed by a lot of the stuff he's said. But those are all words so far, and soon we'll see actions. But fingers firmly crossed, because it's not about politics. It's not about this is this team wearing this rosette compared to that team wearing that. It's about our health. It's about our life expectancy. It's about our children's well-being. It's about, will our children have a health service that's free at the point of access? And that's the fairest way to apportion health. And I really hope that it turns around, because I don't think there's a huge amount of time of things. I don't think things can go wrong for much longer before it reaches the point of no return.
So taking you back to what you now say is the golden days for This Is Going to Hurt, it has been hugely successful. And when I read it, I felt it was very true. It was very real. Lots of it resonated with my experience. But especially when the TV show came out, there were lots of women who felt it demeaned their experiences, and you got called all sorts of things along the way, from sexist to misogynist. And I'd love to know, first of all, what inspired you to write it, and then how you felt when that backlash came out, particularly after the TV show.
So I decided to make the TV show very different to the book. And I centered the TV show on mental health of doctors, which is something that I've worked as hard as I can to bang the gong for since I've left the profession. And the show was based around a junior doctor who was fictionalized, but based on people who I knew, sadly, called Shruti, who at the end, this is quite a major spoiler, but I mean, people have had the best part of 2 years to watch it, who at the end of the series takes her life. And it's hopefully the series is an exploration of that, which makes it much, much darker than the book and very different in lots of ways. But one junior doctor in the UK takes their life every 3 weeks. A nurse in the NHS takes their life every single week. It never gets talked about. And this was my opportunity to bring this issue to 10 million people a week on the BBC. And I was very grateful to the BBC for allowing me to have that platform and tell this story and raise this awareness. And and since then, there's, you know, we've seen some things change in all sorts of ways. I've had opportunities to speak to all sorts of important people, and, you know, a little thing that's happened is that a charity that I worked with getting this storyline respectful and an appropriate Doctors in Distress, we're now working very closely together, and I've planted lots of trees outside hospitals, which echoes something that happened in the series. There was a memorial tree to this doctor, Shruti, in the series, and it turned out there was no memorial in the UK to healthcare workers who've lost their lives to suicide. So since that, we started at the hospital where this was the exteriors were shot at Ealing Hospital in West London. And since then, we've been around, you know, a dozen or more other hospitals. And I think we've got the cash together now to offer every NHS organisation who wants this, that, you know, the chance to have a tree planted like that. And that's not going to make a difference. It's only a tree, but it admits that there's a problem. And I think this is a problem that through, you know, stigma and shame and taboo just gets brushed under the carpet. So I'm very proud that when a show can have real life consequences. So And on your other point, I tend not to read too much backlash because I don't read too much whatever the opposite is of backlash, because I think it can drive you a bit mad in either direction. I think it can turn people into ego monsters if they only read the positive stuff. I'm very proud of the series, and which was, you know, a series, you know, other than me, I think pretty much everyone who in senior roles was a woman who made the show, you know.
It was also very funny, aside from the backlash.
Yeah, okay, good. I think if you're a doctor, it's not a funny show because it's
well,
too
funny.
Realistic, potentially. As a lot of doctors said, how close to home it was. And also I spoke to lots of people who weren't doctors who found it difficult to watch because they didn't have their easiest experience on labour ward. And what it wasn't was a varnished version. And I wanted to paint a story that showed a system that was struggling, and it showed people who were struggling, and it showed people, healthcare staff, behaving in bad, you know, in ways that they shouldn't necessarily because of the pressures they were under. And I've not read a lot of this stuff, because why would you expose yourself to that? But I suspect people may have thought I was trying to glorify behavior, whereas in fact I was trying to show the opposite. And people behaved badly because they were under stress or the system wasn't supporting them. And then there were consequences to that. I think that every single badly behaved member of staff who acted in a way they shouldn't sees consequences to their actions as the series goes on. So, I mean, then again, you can't say or do anything and please anyone or everyone. I hope to please some people, but I was very proud of what we did, and in particular what we've achieved in terms of raising the awareness of the mental health struggles of healthcare staff, which is what I set out to do.
I think you absolutely did that brilliantly. Do you have any plans to turn any other books into TV adaptations? Obviously, a bit easier with fiction books, you know, the ones that you're starting to write now. But when you think about other kids' TV shows about medicine and about science, it's totally possible with your non-fiction books too. Is that in the pipeline at all?
It's not in the pipeline, but it could. I could shove it down the pipe at some point. I'm very lucky at the moment in that I'm very busy with my books, and I haven't really thought about that a huge amount. I guess I love the idea of educating kids, and so far I've been doing that with my non-fiction books, and I dare say there's other ways of doing it through telly or also on the stage. I must say I've had, so I tour a grown-up show, stand-up comedy. I had one for This Is Gonna Hurt. I'm on tour with Undoctored at the moment, which is my latest book for grown-ups, and loads of people come up to me, as you know, I'll hang around afters and sign books if people want that. And loads of people say, my 9-year-old was desperate to come to this, but I think it's just as well that I said no. And the answer is yes. But that does make me think maybe I should do some theatre events for younger kids. I've done quite a bunch of school events, which are great fun. No one asks questions like kids, and no one's honest like kids.
Well, I want to ask you about that, Adam. So, of course, we've talked about your children's books. I have to thank you, I think, for your first kids' book, Kay's Anatomy, because it prompted my first birds and bees chat with my eldest daughter. But it gave her more questions than answers, so I'm not sure I actually thank you. But what made you decide to write for kids after This Is Going to Hurt? Because that's a brilliant book for kids, and both of my girls have really enjoyed the way the pictures especially are good as well. It's just a great introduction to the body for kids. Why did you go for kids after your first book?
I think the body is amazing and fascinating and brilliant. And I think everyone should think this and everyone should understand their bodies. And, you know, like we were talking about before, you know, prevention better than cure. Right at the very start of it is understanding your body and, you know, when something's not right and when to speak to someone and what to. And I think that's something you should know from the very start. And I think potentially kids don't think it's an exciting thing or an amazing thing because they're forced to learn about it at school. And I wanted to have a go at including all the facts, but making it funny and silly and memorable and just, you know, seeing what I could persuade kids that they wanted to learn about. And it's a very chunky book. It's, you know, it's 400 plus pages. It's got all the human biology you need to know, you know, GCSE and beyond, but in a hopefully funny way, and not just the facts, the stuff they'll have to know for their exams. It doesn't shy away from talking about neurodiversity, and we talk about mental illness, and we talk about body image, and we talk about smoking and drugs, and also there's a chapter on reproduction, because that's an important thing. And I got a huge amount of help and advice across the book, but particularly for that chapter, getting it age appropriate, making sure that, you know, I'm using all the right language, and but also somehow keeping it light enough that it doesn't then change into a totally different book for a chapter before going back to disgusting facts about snot or whatever. So that's the chapter that I've had most parents say to me, oh, cheers for that. Because I'm very lucky. I'm trained and vaguely knowledgeable in that. Plus, I had, you know, a year and a half of working with other people to get it right. And that's potentially easier for me than for a random mum being hijacked by a child saying, right, tell me about babies. So hopefully if I can subcontract, you know, some of that work in the book, then they're obviously going to have a million questions still, but better for them to learn it from me. I'm hopefully more accurate than their friend Marcel in the playground.
I think you are. And as we've mentioned, Dexter Proctor, the 10-year-old doctor, is your first foray into fiction. Tell us about Dexter, but also I'm really interested to know what made you switch from nonfiction to fiction writing.
So Dexter, I think the title, it's a fairly Ron Seal proposition. He's a 10-year-old doctor. He's quite a high level genius. He was born speaking. He sort of, you know, smashed his way through all Wikipedia by the time he was about 6 months old, finished school with, you know, 80 odd A levels before too long. And then saw something on the news about the lack of doctors, and was like, you know, I reckon I can do that. And he's pretty good at the whole doctoring thing, and hopefully hilarity ensues. Hopefully I want it to be more than just a funny book, which hopefully it is. I want it to demystify hospitals a bit, which I think for kids are weird, unknowable places. Oh no, this person's gone to hospital. What does that mean? I've got to go to hospital. This sounds awful. There's a lot of, by the nature of the stories and the things he's investigating and the patients he's helping, there's a lot of, you know, medicine sort of gently sprinkled in there. So hopefully there's some learning to do. And also Dexter's, even though he's got this sort of, you know, almost superpower with his, you know, with his medical brain, he does struggle to fit in and find his way. And he's got, you know, he's got some people who aren't such a fan of him, both at school and at work. And no, it's about finding your way through life. So even though he's not directly relatable, because there's probably not a huge number of 10-year-old doctors going to be reading it, hopefully people can see a bit of themselves in some of the issues he goes through. And it's once again, it's illustrated by Henry Packer, who's illustrated all of my nonfiction books before, and is Henry's a comedian by trade, as well as a writer and illustrator, and he adds so much comedy to it. And we write it all together, and it's a big collaborative process. It's been great fun to write. We've had really lovely feedback from the people who've read early copies, like people like, you know, Jacqueline Wilson and Frank Cottrell Boyce, and yeah, all my kids writing heroes have been so sweet about it. So fingers crossed that some of the actual reading age will enjoy it when it's out. Why fiction? I love fiction. I love telling stories. A lot of the stuff I write for telly is fiction. It's something I've never done on in books before, but I think it's a fun idea, and it's one I've wanted to write, and we'll find out whether the audience agrees.
Fingers crossed. Thank you, Adam. It has been a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Lovely to speak to you.
Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on all social channels, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. Just type in Netmoms and you'll find us. And if you liked what you've heard today, we'd love for you to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button, and share the podcast on all your socials.